Okay, today is November 14th, 2013. This is the first interview with Bob Mitchell. We are here at his office in Ag Hall, and my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Bob, I know we tested it in test mode, but for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Bob Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L.
That's going to be great. Thank you, Bob. You gave me a list, sounded like a brief biography, in advance of this first session. So I want to start by saying that I think the topic for today, the overarching topic, is your time in Madison between 1955 and 76.
The early days.
The early days, indeed. So you said that you lived in Madison since 1955, but does that mean you were born somewhere else?
No, I was born in Frederick, Maryland. My father, who was a plant pathologist, actually got his PhD here in Madison. You know, he was one who part of the post-war generation. After he got his PhD, he went to work for the Army in Frederick, Maryland, Fort Detrick, where they studied actually chemical and biological warfare, and he was reporting on possibilities for whether or not crops could be, altered on purpose, creating diseases. And so we were there. He was there for 10 years, and I was born halfway through there. I was born in 1951, and we moved to Madison when I was 5 years old, just after my fifth birthday. We moved here. We lived our first 6 months in university houses while they were looking for a place to live, which was pretty nice. And it was back before they had Eagle Heights. It was way off in the country there. And I went to school for my first half of kindergarten at Shorewood Elementary.
So I want to get something on the record that seems to be, want to make sure, and you may have already mentioned it. So did your father get a job back here
as a faculty? Yes, yes, yes. He came here as a professor, got a faculty job.
Okay. And so since you grew up near campus, I assume you have some early memories of being on campus. It might initially revolve around your father's location. So where was your father's office?
His office was in the second floor of what is now the horticulture wing of the plant sciences building, Moore Hall. He was on the second floor there. The plant pathology department then was located on the second floor of Ag Hall. They built Russell Lab sometime in the 60s, and so he was there until then.
So then he moved to Russell Labs after it was built?
Right, he actually was on the chair of the committee that built Russell Labs. I can remember taking tours of when they were building the building, going up when they were making when it was still concrete, going up in the construction zone. And he was, Moore Hall was where he was for that first part. And I do remember visiting him there quite a few times.
So you said early on, or not early on, but during your time in Madison, well, you said you lived in university houses, but then you have a note here that you also lived on the Near East Side.
Well, I live on the Near East Side now.
Oh, okay. All
yeah.
right.
We moved to Eaton Ridge, which is about a mile from campus, and lived there until, all the way until I was out of high school. My parents moved later than that, and so I lived there. Lived there from kindergarten through high school.
Okay. Eaton Ridge, what high school did that find?
West High. Okay. It was three blocks south of West High School.
Okay.
And I went to elementary school at Randall.
So when did you start selling soda at Badger games?
That was, it's interesting, they just stopped that this year. That was something that almost everybody I knew, I only did that for 1 year. I think a lot of people only did it for 1 year because it was interesting and kind of fun to go to the games, but it wasn't all that lucrative. But I did that probably when I was in seventh grade.
Okay.
Sold Coke.
Okay.
Coke and other stuff like that. Learned the worst thing to sell was Mighty Malts November. Mighty Malts don't sell well in November.
So was that after that Rose Bowl in 63?
That would have been, yeah.
Okay.
a much smaller Camp Randall in those days.
Yeah, it's been changed a few times since then.
Yes.
And then you also said that you worked in the res hall kitchens during high school?
Sure. I worked in my first, after my sophomore year in high school, I worked in, I think it was Holt Commons over in the lake, the newer part of the Lakeshore dorms, and I worked in the dish room and worked in the cafeteria and used to hang out on the pier. They had a pier out in Lake Monona and Mendota, and we would go out and hang out on the pier between our morning, noon, and evening shifts. It was pretty nice. It was kind of country club-like setting.
Mm-hmm.
It was not glamorous work, but it was fun to be down there when you're sophomore in high school and hanging around all the college kids and college girls out on the pier and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So,
You don't want to hear about my thoughts about on campus. I mean, just my memories of being campus,
sure.
Visiting, because I do, you know, I do remember when I was younger, then my we'd come down. I can remember the used to hang out in the horticulture garden, now in the Allen Centennial Gardens, but the horticulture garden used to be right in the behind the, or kind of in the between the agronomy and horticulture wings of the plant sciences building. I can remember the sundial was down there. We used to go, which is now in Allen Centennial Gardens, we used to go and play with the sundial. And my father had a lot of plots, or I should say had a lot of, he had plants in the Walnut Street greenhouses. We'd go down at night and help him water the plants. And in those days, there was an old orchard up on Picnic Point, and up at the top, I think it was part of the old farm that was up there, and he did, in his early years, he did a lot of fruit research, and we used to go up there and help him pick apples and hang out and just be up there when he was doing some of his research up there.
By we, do you mean?
My brothers and I. You know, okay. I'd go up with my father, but my brother would go up with me as well.
Okay. Where does a brother fall? Is he older or younger?
I've got two brothers. One brother is 2 years older. And the other one, I think, is 7 years older.
Okay.
So the one who's 2 years older, we were, you know, we did a lot more together.
Right.
Used to, my aunt and uncle were on campus too. My aunt and uncle were researchers in McCarlo Labs, did cancer research. And I can remember we used to go with them too when we'd have our Thanksgiving Christmas dinners together, and so we'd go down on holidays. They wanted to give all their staff the day off, and so we would go down before or after Christmas dinner and feed the rats in their rat rooms. That was a lot of fun. I was always looking forward to that.
Was McCardle inside the hospital at that time?
It started out in the it was over, I think it was in the corner of Charter and Linden. It was in that research, part of that whole hospital medical research complex. And I remember they built Russell Lab sometime. I can't remember when they built it, but I remember my aunt and uncle were pretty involved in that. We always thought the design was kind of strange, and I always thought that was kind of a failure with it. You know, all those bricks on the outside and everything always looked kind of, never looked all that attractive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, having an office in Steenbach that faces Russell Lab.
Russell Lab is pretty plain too.
Yeah.
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 It's not the worst though. I mean, look at the genetics building. It looks like it was made with Lego sets or something like that. So.
Yeah, it is an interesting campus to walk around and look at the buildings and wonder what was on their mind.
There was a period that one of my colleagues refers to as Cold War bland.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this when we met several months ago for the pre-interview. Who were your aunt and uncle? What were their names?
Elizabeth and James Miller.
And how were they related to your...
My mother is... Elizabeth Miller is my mother's sister.
Okay. Did they have children too?
Yeah, they've got two kids. They've got daughter who's I think a year or so younger than me, and then they have another daughter who is probably four years younger than me, something like that.
Okay.
And one of them lives, the younger one's a biology professor at University of Kansas, and the other one lives in Wausau. She does historical costumes and things like that. Huh. She's an awesome seamstress.
Huh. Neat.
Yeah, it's very cool. My mother actually taught her to sew, which was pretty cool that she ended up doing that.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like most of your memories are centered on this part of campus to a certain extent. Is that a correct assumption?
Well, this was kind of the end of campus in those days. I mean, I talked about the Walnut Street greenhouse. That was, that was kind of out in the sticks. There were still quite a few. I can remember before the natatorium was built. So there were a lot of plots between the farm and, what was then the more active part of the farm and all the way out there where the hospital is now. That was all. Those were all plots as well. But when you're a kid in Madison, those days it was pretty accessible. It's pretty easy to get down to campus. And we used to ride our bikes down, hang around the Union, go down to the Historical Society, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
When we were really little, we used to go every Sunday. We'd have dinner in the Union cafeteria after church.
And did you go to church on campus?
Went to church at the First Congregational Church.
Okay.
Just across the street from campus.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Lots of university people there.
So when you were growing up, Humanities wasn't built either.
I can remember when it was built.
Okay.
Yeah, Humanities was built when I was in high school. It was kind of... I'm sure there's plenty of archival stuff about that, but they had a fence around Humanities when they were building it, wooden mm-hmm. board fence, and it became this easel for graffiti. All this very interesting. It was a very political time. It was great political graffiti. You'd get down there. So if ever you were doing any kind of event or having something to advertise or whatever, people say you had to go down and paint the fence. I always wondered if they saved any of that or took pictures of any of that or collected any of that, because it was quite a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm. And you were in high school and
graduated in 69.
Okay.
1967 through 69 in high school.
Okay. So as a high school student, did you ever come down here to just sort of be a part of what was going on during the student protest movement?
Protests. I didn't, not so much when the protests are going on. I remember hearing about it. I remember my father talking about it, and I remember seeing it going on campus. And I think there were friends of mine that did that. But I can remember the first Mifflin Street block party. I didn't go to the party itself, but I remember kind of being curious at the very end. I knew what was going on, and I went down there. And my brother and I were just going down, kind of walking down toward there, and we saw somebody about a block away, and they said, "Don't go down there, the cops are really pissed." So that's as close as we got. That was the one that those first couple of parties got busted up by the cops.
Right.
It was a different time when Mayor Soglin was the alder person.
Mm-hmm.
Got arrested at the first block party.
Right. And
but the protests themselves, no, I was, back when I got into college, when I was older, sure, everybody was part of that.
Mm-hmm. So let's maybe transition into that then. Why did you decide to come here for undergraduate?
Well, I actually went away to Colorado State University my freshman year. It was... when you grew up in those days, and just, I guess, the people I hang out with in West High School, I hang out with a lot of people I knew were, university brats like me, sons and daughters of faculty members, and it was kind of like the idea was, among a lot of us, was the last thing you wanted to do was end up living in Madison and then growing up and going to campus here. You wanted to go somewhere else, so I went out to Colorado State University, mostly because I was looking for a smaller school, and I was looking for some place where I could ski, and... that worked out pretty well. I had a roommate who was, his parents had condos in Aspen and Vail, so I got to do a lot of skiing. But it was, beyond that, I wasn't, wasn't particularly enamored of the school, and it's at the time it seemed like kind of an expensive, the out-of-state tuition seemed kind of expensive. I think it was like $500 a quarter, but that seemed like a lot of money in those days. And so I decided to come back here and go to school here.
So was that, did you spend one whole year at Colorado State?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my big foray out of Madison. Other than that, I was in Madison pretty much from 5 years old on.
Right. Huh.
I came back here and I lived, I had a good friend of mine from high school who also went to Colorado State, and we both came back that second year. We got a room in a former fraternity house on Mendota Court, which is about a half block long street down by the, it's along the lake down by the Wisconsin Center, well, what's now the Pyle Center. Mm-hmm. And there were like two fraternities, and we were kind of a rooming house in between those two fraternities. So that was my sophomore year.
Okay. And it says in the summers, starting in 69, you worked at the exhibit shop in UW Ag Journal.
Right. When I was my summer after my senior year in high school, and then the next two summers after that, yeah, there was a guy, assistant professor in ag journalism named Pete Willoughby, and he was in charge of the exhibits program, and they had a shop at that time. The shop was kind of like itinerant. The 3 years I worked there, I think it was at a different location. At least I think it was that we were moving it out. It used to be by what was an old slaughterhouse, I think, was being torn down. They moved that to a Quonset hut over probably about where the Dairy Forge Center is now. And that was where our shop was. And then later on, they moved it over to a university-owned house over on Dayton Street, across the street from where the Southeast Dorms are now, over next to where University Press was. So we were in a basically operating out of a two flat over there, but it was a largely UW extension operation. And, you know, the college and extension were pretty much integrated in those days. The extension, cooperative extension, was part of the college in those days, and ag journalism was the communication work for the college, and they had they did exhibits that went around all the county fairs, and then extension had a building at the state fair too, and so we basically filled that building at the state fair with exhibits. They had different exhibits every year, kind of themes of the kind of stuff they were doing, and then the county fair exhibits, they hired one guy to, they had all these old, surplus pickup trucks. They had one guy that drove around and would take these exhibits to the county fairs. He'd take them around to the various county fairs, like on 1 week, and he'd go around and he'd pick them up and bring them around, take them to other county fairs the next week. And these were like, exhibits are kind of like extension brochures combined down to an exhibit, and they were like basically 4x8 sheets of plywood, and they'd cut them in half and put a piano hinge down between the two of them, and then set those up on these welded metal frames, and they'd have they just have the information, photos and letters and stuff on the pasted onto the exhibits, they didn't have a lot of purchase exhibits. Nowadays they have exhibits, but they mostly the buy exhibits, but in those days everything was pretty much constructed that way, so these are really heavy and really bulky, but that was the option they had. Mm-hmm. And they were, just whatever. They were, food safety and crop stuff, the a lot of the same kind of basic agriculture and the home ec information that they still have, except it was, 50 years ago it was a lot simpler. Then they had a couple of trailers. One was called the Meat Mobile. These are old beat up trailers, but they were like, pretty good sized former house trailers, and they had exhibits in those, and so we'd go in there. They were already existing when I had that job, but we went in and changed the exhibits and refurbished the exhibits, and they had a guy that it was his job to drive around all the county fairs. He'd drive around to a different one every weekend, and Dan just parked the meat mobile there, and then his job was to sit outside and grill meat all day, and then he'd serve samples of meat to the people that came to the exhibits. I always thought that'd be a pretty good job. When it was on campus and we were working on the thing, he would bring meat and we would grill it and we'd eat it there. Mm. And they had another one called the Family Living Trailer, which is basically the same thing for home economics type exhibits. And it went around to county fairs too. And so we worked on refurbishing that. I don't mean to, we had a crew of about four people plus those guys that did the driving around, and those crews were led by Willoughby hired a MFA candidate from the art department who was really, really talented in the workshop. I've always liked to do workshop stuff, and I learned a lot of what I did from him, just, mm-hmm. you know, working with all the tools and the materials and just kind of getting that whole idea that you can make things out of anything, you know. And I didn't come up with the ideas, but I was part of the crew that did that. You know, mm-hmm. four guys that were basically, they're mostly college age people that were working on that crew. And then the State Fair exhibit was a pretty big deal. That was, we worked on that for weeks before the fair happened. And it was a pretty good sized pavilion, and we'd have exhibits all the way around the outside. And again, it was the same kind of stuff, except these would be more, instead of being those folding traveling exhibits, they'd be more like just vertical flats, and you'd have information and all these different things in there. And then usually something big in the middle. And the one I remember best was, this was back in probably 70, you know, it was the first Earth Day, and they had the environment was everything was about the environment. The main theme of the whole exhibit, the whole building, was the environment. So we had kind of the signature exhibit was a big junk pile that was in the middle of the building. It was a tall, you know, one of these, you know, two-story buildings, you know, about this, you know, at least as tall as a stock pavilion. And for weeks before the fair, we would go around on trash days, wherever there's always trash day somewhere in Madison, but you go ahead of the trash truck looking for interesting trash. And we took the trash, we piled it up, we, you know, looked for all kinds of interesting things, and then we kept hauling it up to the State Fair. And then the week before the fair, we just started building this pile, just kind of like, it was kind of like sculpture, you know. The whole pile was probably, you know, 20 feet tall, and we had, like, at the top we had a, you know, an old sink, and we had water piped up to that, and the sink would go down, and then kind of like water drip from the sink down through a toilet, and then we'd go from the toilet down to a bathtub at the very bottom and recycle it. And then there were all these quotes around the outside of it that were quotes about the environment, different people about environmental issues. And then there's a sign in the middle from Pogo that said, "We have met the enemy and he is us," or something like that. But it was kind of cool. I remember that trash pile got featured in the State Journal, or the Milwaukee Journal that year, and that was, we're pretty proud of that. It was fun. People used the bathtub where the water ended up in, they threw pennies in it, so. And then somebody else would come by and steal all the pennies. We were thinking we'd get to use those, but it was fun. We'd go up and stay on the fairgrounds. We lived in the administration building, had this little house on the fairgrounds. We'd stay above live in the rooms up above the headquarters. Us and Alice in Dairyland, living in the same, not in the same rooms, but.
Right. All right, so it sounds like for the county fair stuff, you didn't then go to the county fair and sort of pursue.
No, we did go to Farm Progress Days. Now they call it Farm Tech Days. Back in those days, they called it Farm Progress Days. But we didn't stay up there, but we went up there and hauled and helped set up the exhibits and stuff. Those days were just like now. The Farm Progress Days always would have terrible weather. They'd have tents, and the tents would blow over and everything. But I didn't go to the county fairs.
And Farm Progress Days, like it is now, would be somewhere different each?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, be on somebody's farm.
And thank you for that. That was good. I think if there's something else I wanted to ask about that. I guess not. If it comes to me, I will jump in. So you came back here in the fall of 1970?
Yep. Yeah, I came back here and started school in the fall of 1970.
So just basically a week or 10 days, maybe 2 weeks after the Sterling Hall bombing?
Yeah, the Sterling... Actually, I was... the night of the Sterling Hall bombing, I was at the State Fair. And we kind of rotated who stayed up at the fair and other people would drive up to the fair during the fair itself. And so I was staying over at the fair then. I remember whoever it was, the crew, the guys that came up from campus that day, they came up there and said, yeah, somebody who thought the revolution had started, I remember it was a quote, the guy said, yeah, somebody thought the revolution had started and, you know, set a bomb on campus. So I was, I lived close to my phone. We lived close to campus. My parents heard the explosion. Everybody heard the explosion, but I was in Milwaukee. That was my alias or my alibi at the time. But I remember that because we came back to campus that night or the next day. And my main memory of that is there was campus still in the late 60s had these old World War II surplus buildings that they did, during World War II or after, I think it was after World War II, to kind of handle the excess of the baby boom generation. So they had all these little buildings all over campus, and they had a set of them, the corner of Linden and Babcock Drive, you know, where the corner of the Microbial Sciences building is now. Back in those days, the bacteriology building. And so right there at the corner, they had at least one of those, buildings, and that was an ROTC facility of some kind. And I can remember there was we were walking by the horticulture building, and there were some guys coming out of the horticulture building with all these, I can't remember what they're carrying, but all these various, you know, some kind of apparatus and stuff. And they said, yeah, they were, this is their research. And they were afraid that the ROTC, that building, was going to be the next target and get blown up. And they didn't want to lose whatever it is they're doing their research. They were moving it somewhere else. It was kind of the mode at that point, you know. It was just so new and so strange, and they didn't know what was going to happen next. So.
Mm-hmm. So when you were on campus in the early 70s, while the war was still going on, did you participate in any of the war protests?
Yes. It was kind of thing that, I won't say everybody did it because I didn't hang out with everybody, and, you know, there were plenty of people that did not, but when they had, you know, these things that would kind of erupt when there's something would happen in Vietnam, you know, when they mined the harbors in Hanoi or Haiphong or whatever it was. I remember that, or they had the Cambodian incursion. There would be things that would just spark it, and then they would have rallies on the streets, and they'd have, would start at Library Mall, and then they'd go, you know, they'd march up State Street, or they'd march up Langdon about down State Street, the Capitol. So it was like, you know, tens of thousands of people, and I was one of those. Mm-hmm. I can remember walking down State Street from the Capitol down toward Library Mall, and they'd have, they had cops lined up with along all the side streets. So you couldn't go off, like you're going down State Street, you couldn't go off on Henry or something like that. They wanted to just channel everybody. They didn't want people running off in different ways. And they were cops in riot gear, and they were all really, you know, understandably, they're in foul moods, you know. They weren't happy. You know, for a lot of us, I mean, it was people were pretty upset about the war. It was something that was just, you know, in those days, everybody that, the people that I knew, And people, you know, we thought it was everybody. I'm sure it wasn't, but, you know, they were pretty outraged about the war, and so everybody participated in that kind of stuff. I can't tell you that I was, you know, any kind of central in that. And it was, you know, it was like, I don't want to say it was social, but, you know, it was an interesting time, and so you do that. And then, you know, in those days, I lived a couple of years on West Dayton Street, just, you know, just on the fringes of Mifflin. And I remember sitting on my front porch, and you just watch these. You know, you couldn't be on the streets, because if you had more than two people together, that could be declared an unlawful assembly, and they'd pitch tear gas at you. So there weren't a lot of people on the streets. And but you'd see these cars going by, police cars, and they'd have three cops in the front and three cars in the back with riot gear, and they just, it was a strange feeling, you know. It was almost like you felt you were in occupied territory. It was just, it wasn't, it's just kind of the, you know, the emotion you had of the time. It was, you know, really a different feeling. You know, you didn't see people on campus going around in uniforms now like you do now. You know, people in the service or in ROTC on campus, and they wear the uniforms and stuff, and it was really uncommon in those days. They wouldn't do that because it just, you know, people weren't going up and thanking them for their service in those days.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever at an event or a protest where you got tear gas?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. And that was pretty much every one of them.
Okay.
And then it was kind of strange. The house we lived in on 500 block of Dayton Street, this was, you know, we'd lived there for several years, and one day we just, for some reason, decided to scrub the dining room floor. I don't know why, because it wasn't like we did a lot of cleaning, but I remember we thought that'd be a good idea. We scrubbed the dining room floor, and all of a sudden the house was just, it was like, it was filled, we all started crying. It was filled with tear gas, you know, I mean, like tear gas. And it turned out, we found out later that before we'd lived there, that house had been gassed, you know, they'd pitched a tear gas into the house, and so it must have been in the woodwork. We scrubbed the floors, and tears are running down our face, and this is probably 3-4 years after it happened. It was in the woodwork, literally.
So when you came back here, did you know what you wanted to major in?
No, not really. Typically, I was. I think my major was humanities out in Colorado. I majored in. At least I began the journalism program, the regular journalism program, and in the School of Journalism, which in those days was in the former Wisconsin High building over in the corner, bottom of Henry Mall, Henry Mall and University Avenue, the old high school building. But that's where journalism was in those days. And so I went to school a year and a half, and then I took a hiatus. But yeah, I was studying journalism in those days. Took my class in those days, and writing was, it was like the thing I could do pretty well. It wasn't difficult for me, so it was something that I was pretty adept at, so it was a comfortable place for me to go. It was a comfortable skill. I didn't, it was interesting, but I didn't do a lot of stuff in journalism outside of that part at that point. Like I say, I went to school for a year and a half. You know, after we moved into the house in Mifflin, it's like we moved in there with four high school friends, and our parents were all afraid, oh, they're going to move down there and they're going to drop out of school, you know. And well, we all were there for a semester, and after I was there for a semester, I dropped out of school. Dropped out of school for a year and a half. And, you know, I just did odd jobs. That was, I did one of my summers at the, I think one of my summers at the, at least one of them at the, working for the exhibit shop after that. And I got a job working for a season. I worked on the grounds crew at the Arboretum from whenever that would have been, like from the maybe May through October or something like that. That was a great job. It was fun. And then winter after that, I worked as a tree trimmer for a couple of different companies for probably another year or something like that. And I think it was working as a tree trimmer, I think it made me realize that it was enough to motivate me. It was kind of an interesting job for a way, but you know, it's just a, it was a pretty dead-end crew, a pretty dead-end, it wasn't going to go anywhere. I was the only person on that crew that had not been in jail, and I just thought, you know, that got old pretty fast. So then I thought, you know, decided I was going to go back to school. And I was, you know, like I say, that was Earth Day. And I mean, that was when the environmental movement was really getting kicked off. And I'd gone on a long, like a 4-week canoe trip the summer before I went back to school. And I was, you know, I was going to go back and go be a forest ranger or something like that. So I went to, instead of back to school, I remember I went and talked to somebody in forestry about majoring in that. And it was actually in those days, it was called forest science. And I realized right away that it was going to require a lot of calculus, and you know, math was always my nemesis in high school, and I never wanted to take any more. So we started looking around, and looking around at other possible majors, and we realized that soil science probably had the fewest prerequisites and didn't require calculus in those days. So I decided to major in soils, which, you know, that's a choice which I've never regretted. I mean, it's a pretty interesting field. It's really great. It's a basic field, you know. It's like there's everything in agriculture and natural resources and water quality, everything, and really it's tied to all that stuff. And so it's been a you know, really good foundation for all the writing I've done, you know, the writing and communications work I've done, because it's always been related to agriculture, natural resources, or, you know, even the microbiology is very soil related. So, but I was, and my advisor was named Ed Engelbert, and he was a really great guy. And he sat me down one day, you know, this is probably, I'd been in it for, I don't know, a year or so. And he said, I think he realized that, maybe I realized that I didn't, you know, it's a really interesting field, but I was pretty sure it was, I didn't have the rigor, I didn't have to be a scientist, you know, the interest in, you know, bulking down to that one thing and staying with it. And, you know, there's a lot of detail in science. I'm fascinated by science, but it's, you know, I think I'm more of a science dilettante. So, and he knew I had these journalism credits, and so he said, maybe I should think about going over and talking to somebody in ag journalism. He knew all these guys. Back in those days, everybody, you know, everybody knew the guys in ag journalism, because anybody had anything to do with communications, they were, I mean, every campus was, it was a smaller feeling that everybody knew everybody anyway. But so he suggested I go over and talk to Lloyd Bostian, who was one of the professors in ag journalism, and talk to him about possibly going over there and doing a transfer, and so, you know, at least doing something with that. And they had in those days they called it it wasn't a minor, it wasn't a double major, it was kind of but it was like that. So basically it was like doing a minor in ag journalism. But as I went on, it became clear to me in the last year and a half that was where I was going to go, because that was, you know, I was, as I said, writing's always been pretty comfortable for me. And it's an interesting field, because you get to look at everything and study everything. And so that's where my degree technically is in soils, but in the end it was pretty clear I was going to go into journalism, agricultural journalism. Mm-hmm.
Did your credits that you took in journalism apply to?
Yeah, that was part of a lot of those credits applied.
Okay. And so you've already mentioned a couple of professors, but maybe specifically as you came back, it sounds like as you came back and became more focused both in soils and ag journalism.
Yeah, yeah.
Were there classes or professors that stood out?
Well, anybody who took soils for about 30 years, anybody who took soils, either in soils or took a, you know, crop sciences class or anything, had Soils 101 from Jim Love. And actually, it was co-taught in those days by Jim Love and Art Engelbert, but yeah, so I took Soils 101 from him. That was 7:45, 3 days a week. And it was always 7:45, and everybody always remembers that when they talk about Soils 101, Jim Love, 7:45. That's like, they always say that, cut it together. But that was, so he was a, you know, he, I mean, he's, I actually, he was at the, he was a turf grass guy. He started the UW turf grass program, and I wasn't into turf grass, but, you know, yeah, he was also the basic soils guy. But he came back to the turf grass field day this year. They had kind of a reunion of the two former and current turf grass people. So I chatted with him a little bit, and of course everybody around was talking about having taken basic soils from him. He's about 90 now, but yeah, so I remember Jim Love pretty well. And Ed Engelbert, he helped teach some of the classes in soils, and he was mostly my advisor, but he was a really nice guy, and he had a lot of interesting stories to tell. Let's see, who else in soils? There was Art Peterson, and Dick Corey taught the soil water and soil conservation class, and which is a pretty interesting class because then you're you go out and do field trips around the state, and you go up and you fly in a small plane so you can look at the contours and go and see former gullies, places that were gullies in the during the Depression that got filled in and corrected, because you know Wisconsin had some of the first soil conservation projects in the country. Emmett Schulte, he's an emeritus professor now. He taught soil and plant nutrition, soil and plant nutrition. And then ag journalism, of course, I ended up in ag journalism, so I knew a lot of the people from later on, but I remember them too from the class. I was in ag journalism as a, you know, working as a part-timer in the summers too, so I knew people from there. So Claren Burnett people taught a lot of classes in ag journalism, small departments, people traded off, but he taught, he was involved in the exhibits program quite a bit. He did a lot of the photography, you know, what we call meatball photography. He wasn't like a, you know, high-end photographer, but he did a lot of stuff, and he taught publication layout and design. And in those days, publication layout and design, it was almost like kindergarten. They had, like, they'd come into the class, and they'd have stacks of magazines, old magazines, and they'd have, you know, drawing boards and T-squares and scissors and contact cement. He would basically, like, you know, mock up designs by cutting stuff out of old magazines and catalogs and pasting them down, pasting and type and stuff like that. So that was, it's pretty funny. I remember years later in ag journalism, I'd still find all the, you know, find these drawers with all these old scissors and the drawers full of T-squares and stuff like that. That was back, you know, when they were, everything was getting to be digital in those days. So, Lloyd Boston taught the Edling class, and I always thought the Edling class was the best writing class I ever had, because Edling is basically learning how to, you know, write really concisely. So he was, Edling was also about, you know, we'd take field trips to places where they did printing, so we learned how printing worked, things like that, you know, which in those days was offset printing. He did a good job of teaching Edling, and I always thought that probably as far as writing, that was the best class I had, just because it taught me how to be concise.
So you said you had a, I guess I'll use the word predilection, or you were felt you were adept at writing?
Oh yeah, it's like when I was in high school, you know. It's funny, I talked to one of our former editors around here that was the same kind of stuff. It's like if you could write something, if you in high school, if you could write something well, it helped. You know, it helped. You know, your research, your stuff might not have been as bad as deep as something, but when you write a paper, if you can, you know, I was able to write it pretty well, and that sometimes style helps you make up for the lack of content.
So these other classes that dealt with design or production, did you find those interesting, or was it really journalism for you was being able to write?
Well, and it was everything in those days. I mean, it was, you know, you never knew what you're going to end up in, and as it turned out, you know, design, knowing how the printing stuff worked. And I also didn't take a photography class, but I took a independent study in photography with one of the grad students and one of the assistant professors there, because in those days, anybody that came out of ag journalism, probably a lot of people came out of journalism too, but especially ag journalism, everybody learned how to use a camera, because at least in the small town papers and small magazines it's marketing places, everybody did everything, you know, you take pictures and take cameras too, so yeah, it was all kind of interesting. The writing was something I was pretty good at, but the design is an interesting thing. It's an interesting, so I can't say I was the best designer in the world, but I've worked with really good designers my whole career, and it's always been good to be able to have a little bit of sense of that. And, you know, I've always, you know, I've done a lot of publication work as an editor, and it's always really useful to know how the printing presses work. I mean, now, offset printing is often, I mean, they still do offset printing for big jobs, and mostly it's laser printing, but that's still their digital printing, but it's that was really useful. And yes, interesting.
Mm-hmm. For either ag journalism or soil science, did you have a final senior project?
Did I have a final senior project? They didn't have what they called capstone projects in those days. They had, you know, each class might have had something major. The one I remember was they had a, I think they called it publicity, media, and methods. And for that, you broke into small groups and you did some kind of publicity campaign for a nonprofit organization. In fact, I think they probably do something comparable to that now. I'm sure that they do. But so our group did something for the, back then they had the Governor's Council on the Status of Women, which has been, you know, I think Tommy Thompson did away with that some point, but it was, you know, that was a day when gender equity was not taken for granted as much as it is now, and so this was, our campaign was about getting women to make sure that women understood their rights in terms of their rights in terms of getting credits, you know, getting building up their own credit rating, and getting a, you know, not being turned down for loans, not being, you know, being treated equitably. So we did public service announcements and posters, and one I remember best was he did a bus card. Back in those days, the buses had cardboard advertisements along the, you know, up above the seats on both sides. They sold advertisements. They gave away free to things like this, but they also sold them for money too. And you know, sold advertising space. So we did a bus card, bus placard. In that, this is my project, and it said, "Women, have you ever been, you know, have you ever been turned down for a mortgage or things like that?" I remember that most because a friend of mine worked at the Edgerton Reporter in those days. He was the editor, and he did everything in a paper like that. So I went down there one Saturday night and worked on the headline machine, and, you know, which is how you did headlines in those days, and printed out all the type for the thing. And The reason I remember is because we spelled mortgage wrong. We spelled it M-O-R-T-A-G-E, I think, mortage. And it got printed, and that bus card was on the buses for at least 2 years. And every time I'd get on the bus, I'd get up there and I'd see that bus card with that typographical error. It was painful to see, but I've never in my life since then misspelled mortgage.
Mm-hmm. I missed the word elementary in a third grade spelling bee, so that word has never been misspelled.
Yeah, that's good.
In my life.
Yeah, see, there's it's part of the education.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just one, two more things to finish up for the day, and that's what you thought you were going to do once you got your degree. So you graduated in 76. In soil science and ag journalism. So what were your future plans?
Well, I was looking mostly at communication jobs. I think my dream job at that point, I was pretty into photography at the end of that. I took the independent study, and I took some extension classes, and I liked doing photography quite a bit. And like I say, in those days, that was a pretty useful skill. And I think my dream job probably would have been working for a photo agency or something like that. In fact, I was once came in second for a job they had in agriculture back in those days. I'm sure they still have them, you know, agricultural stock photo agencies. So. But I figured it would probably be something in communications, probably be something in agricultural communications. Frankly, I didn't know that much about agriculture. I was, having been brought up in the city, I had always barely been interested in agriculture because, my father was connected to it. My grandfather had grown up on a farm, and he was a farm management. He was a professor in the University of Minnesota, and so I had a lot of connections, a lot of interest in that, but I didn't know that much about agriculture, which was always kind of a challenge when you try to get a job, in that field. But I figured it would be something along those lines, it could have been newspapers or anything, but that was the most likely thing I figured it'd end up in.
Okay. And then maybe just an overview of these couple, looks like you had two jobs between 76 and 82 before you got hired here at UW.
My first job out of school, I had like kind of like little part-time things, writing for, it was the Mount Horeb or the Verona daily paper. I used to cover the county board for them, and I did a short stint with a friend of mine as a vacation editor for the Deep Pier Journal. But in my first job out of school was at a place called Johnson Hill Press in Fort Atkinson, and they did company sponsored magazines for a lot of clients, but the number of them are agriculture related. In other words, what they did was they'd have one of the big clients was the Production Credit Association, which I don't think exists in that form anymore, but that's basically a farm lending organization. So they another one was Ralston Purina. They did newsletters. So they'd do a newsletter for Ralston Purina. Ralston Purina had something like 40 sales districts, and they would do a newsletter every 2 months for every one of those 40 sales districts. So you would, and they needed an on-farm story for every one of those 40 newsletters every 2 months. And so we had, they had an editorial staff. That wasn't directly on that account, but everybody did stories for all the magazines in those days. So we would they had small planes, two-engine planes, and so they'd put a couple of editors in one of those planes, and we'd go out for a week, and we'd fly to, maybe we'd fly to, early Monday morning, we'd fly to Georgia maybe, and they would drop one person off at some tiny airport, and they'd meet up Ralston Purina, they call him Block Man, district representative there,
And then they'd take the other person, they'd drop, they'd fly to another small airport, and they'd drop the other person there to meet another guy there, and then they'd fly back and get the second person and fly them to their aft, you know, so that that person would go off, you know, you'd go off with that district representative, and they'd take you to a farm dealer, and the farm dealer would take you to his best farmer, and you'd go up to the farmer, and you'd do an advertisement. It was always somebody, you know, use the, you know, one of their best customers, and you'd do a little, you'd do a story for the newsletter on that farm, and then you'd come back, and you'd go back to the airport, and the plane had dropped off the second person. The plane would take you and fly you to another story where you're going to do a story in the afternoon. You'd go to another small airport. They'd drop you off. You'd meet another district representative there, and you'd go off and you'd do another story there. Or maybe you'd do a story with the dealer. Often you'd do a story with the dealer and a story with the farmer, and then they go back and pick up the first person. And then so everybody, you'd do two stories a day. And at the end of the day, maybe they'd take you, if you're in Georgia, maybe you'd end up and they'd fly you to another district over in Alabama or Louisiana or Texas, you know, depending where they had to get the stories from. They had in the office, they had this big map of the United States. They had pins all over it where they needed to get stories from, where they had good stories. You know, if you needed to get a story for one magazine, for the one that, like, the, you know, whichever client that was the main person on, you'd look around. They had different color stories for all the clients, and so in order to make it, you know, cost efficient to use those little planes, you'd try to find other stories from the same area, and you'd plot out a week, you know, how you could make those trips. And so, you know, those trips, they didn't always last a week, but often they would. So you'd go out on Monday and come back on Friday, and you would have gotten 10 stories, and to come back Friday night and write the stories up at the end of, you know, often you'd dictate the stories in the planes, and it'd be a lot of flying and, you know, flying late at night. It was kind of, you know, kind of fun because you'd fly late at night and a lot of time spent sitting in little tiny fixed base airports, you know, what do you call them, the private airport, private hangar, private air services, because those planes are always late and you're always waiting and waiting for the planes. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 3 years. We did, you know, we did, it wasn't just the flying around, and it wasn't always private planes. We flew in regular planes too, and did stuff in the office. But I did that for 3 years, and then I was not all that crazy about the job at the end. And it's a marketing job, and I just wasn't that tuned into marketing, and it was, I think they could see that, and I could see that, and they had a downturn, and they lost a client or something like that, and they had to sell their very best plane, and they had to let somebody go. So they sold their favorite plane, and they let me go, and I can tell you they felt a lot worse about selling the plane than they felt about letting me go. So then I ended up freelancing for a couple of years, and I did some freelancing for them, and then the guy that had hired me directly, his name was Galen Morgan. He was in those days, he'd worked for them, but he just went off and was starting his own very small agency. In those days, it was like a one-man agency, and so I would do freelance stories for him as well, for his clients. And then there was another guy in town, a former ag journalism professor, who did a magazine for Alice Chalmers, same kind of thing, where you'd go in and visit their best farmers and do stories for the magazine. So I would go around. In those days, it was usually the expenses were on my nickel. You'd get a flat fee, like I'd get $500 for a story for the Alice Chalmers magazine. So I would go off somewhere, and I'd drive or I'd fly, but I'd again, it was the same kind of thing. You'd try to plot it out and make it as efficient as possible, and you'd go and you visit the farms and write the stories up, and then, you know, you would have to get your expenses and everything out of that. You'd have to make good, which, you know, $500 seemed like a huge amount of money in those days, but, you know, I wasn't really making any money, but I was getting by, and it was an interesting job, interesting thing to do, and got to go around the country a little bit. So mm-hmm. I did that for a couple of years.
Okay. So I want to leave you with the last word. So I asked questions, you answered them about roughly 25 years of your life there. Is there anything on your mind, particularly about the time period here in Madison from from 55 to 76. Any other stories or memories you want to share before we perhaps move on to the second half of your life, your work here from the 80s to the present?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting to look at those times and the time since then. When I think back to that, it was just interesting because, you know, it's interesting when you look at how what you did at one point kind of is a prelude to what you're doing now. I mean, you work in an ag journalism, working in that exhibit shop, you know, it was never any idea to come back on campus and work in that kind of stuff, but it was interesting, you know, and the fact, working with exhibits and stuff, I've always liked to work with my hands, I always liked to work with tools and stuff, and that was interesting stuff to do, but, you know, it was a communications job, and it was an interesting, you know, that was interesting work, and in the end, it was useful work, it was interesting, and, you know, it got me, like I say, well, it's always been an avocation, working with tools and doing woodworking and making stuff, and that lot. I mean, my father was always really adept at that too, so that came, you know, it came by it naturally, but that was important there. And and then, you know, going to West High School, I went to high school with the kids of a lot of the people I ended up working with the campus at the time. I didn't know that. I didn't know all of them, but, you know, I knew their names and did know a lot of them. And then, so you come to campus later and say, oh yeah, I wonder if they're, you know, related to that person. Sure enough, they were, you know. So he was, and some of them I went to, you know, know them pretty well in school and got to know their parents pretty well afterwards when I came to work here. So it's interesting how that connects together, you know. And also, I think just the fact that I mentioned my grandfather, both my grandparents were on the campus up at the University of Minnesota. My grandfather was an ag economist, and my other grandfather was he was in the forest, worked for the Forest Service, I think, but he did forest research. I think he did the forest fire research. In fact, my father spent the first 6 months of his life on a forest experiment station out in California. So it's interesting to think about how that you had that connection, you know, got those roots, you know. My grandfather, the one who was an agricultural economist, he thought he was going to end up being on a farm, you know, stay on the farm, but in New York, but he went to what they called, in those days they had what they called the Farmers Institutes, which were like kind of like traveling farm road shows. They did them here in Wisconsin too, where they just have a number of faculty members go out and spend a couple of days on a weekend or something like that, and farmers would come, and so they'd be like extension work. They'd go off and they'd give lectures about all the different everything farmers would need to know, and back before the days of extension agents. And so he went to one of those farmers' institutes and heard a plant pathologist talk, and he thought, well, this is pretty interesting. He thought maybe he'd like to be a plant pathologist, and he went back to, so he did end up going to school at Cornell and started plant pathology, but decided to, he wanted to be in agriculture economics after all. It's kind of funny that his daughter ended up marrying a plant pathologist, so he had one in the family anyway. But, you know, it's interesting when you come back, because, you know, having been here since then, and, you know, I learned about Farmers Institutes, and I've always been really interested in the history of the place, and the fact we did them here, and then I discovered later, you know, that's how my grandfather got into it, and so there's a connection here, and that's how, it has a lot to do with how I ended up doing what I do, you know, just because you're in this whole culture of people, you know, college, university information, agricultural information, and you know, so it's interesting to kind of, you always look back and look for patterns in your life after the fact, and you start to see them. They're either, you know, either you're making them up or you're trying to fit your life into a pattern, or they're actually there. So,
So Bob, thank you very much. We will talk next time about your at least part of your work here.
Great.
So this concludes the first interview with Bob Mitchell.